living wage and offers benefits. There is a pilot program in Lane County, where I'm from, funded by the Child Care Contributions Tax Credit, that offers a glimpse of what a fully funded subsidy program would look like. It is called the Child Care Enhancement Project and supplements the ERDC program by limiting the copay to 10% of the family's income. This lines up with the Oregon benchmark and federal goals. Paying the provider what the provider charges, increasing the income limit to 85% of state median income, the amount allowed by the federal child care block grant, approximately 250% of the federal poverty level. This project has resulted in a number of success stories. In the interest of time, I'll tell you just one. David, that's not his real name, is a single dad in our area with two children, ages 6 and 4. Both children have behavioral problems stemming from abuse that occurred before they began living with David. The four-year-old still did not speak at age 3 and a half. David's employment is somewhat seasonal. Last winter, he received ERDC. His copay was $335 a month, 18% of his income, and he could not afford the difference between the ERDC rate and what the provider charged. Then, during the summer, when he worked more hours, his income exceeded the ERDC standard, so he was responsible for paying the entire child care bill, over $1,000 a month. He moved in with relatives to cut costs, and the kids didn't even have a bedroom. He still didn't have enough to pay the provider and was going to lose her. Because of the Child Care Enhancement Program, he was able to retain the provider. His copay is now set at $228. This continues through the summer because his income does not exceed the program's limit. His summer income is 166% of 2006 federal poverty level. His youngest son was referred by the provider to a speech development program, and he's now learning to talk. David can now afford a two-bedroom apartment. The kids have their own room, and he sleeps in the living room. His employer is expecting more work this winter, and David is hopeful that he can put the kids on the company health insurance program in February. This is what the ERDC program is supposed to do. The Child Care Improvement POP would be a huge step in that direction. I respectfully came here today from Eugene to ask you to keep David and all the working parents in Oregon who are struggling to make ends meet in mind when you're making your final budget decisions. And for the record, because I can't resist taking this opportunity, I want to tell you that Oregon's been very lucky to have many, many people really devoted to a healthy and high-quality child care system for Oregon, even under really trying times, and done an amazing job on a nickel, is what I would say. So I think you have a lot to be pleased with what you have, an opportunity to build what we must do for our children. And I think I didn't start out by saying, Rep. Boone, how nice it is to see you in that spot, and what a pleasure it is for me to see many of you that I know from years past. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here, Mayor Kersey.
You're welcome.
I'm intrigued by the Lane County Child Care Contribution Tax Credit. Could I get more information?
Yes, I'll make sure that you get fully.
And I just want to use this opportunity to tell co-chairs of the Health Care Reform Committee. One of them was not paying attention to me, though, but that's okay.
So is the other one.
Oh, so is the other one in the back of the room. That Lane County has a lot of good things going. The 100% access, which I'm going to bring before the committee, I think is a model for how we need to, we can reform the healthcare system. I'm really interested in this as a pilot project and as a model that we can do in other places. I mean, that's what makes the system work.
We'll have some money on your doorstep. Very
well, and if you give it, yeah, good. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to see you too, back in the building. Next we have Rosetta Wangren. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burney,
Committee. I'm here as Rosetta Wandgren.
State your name.
Okay. I'm here as Rosetta Wandgren. I'm the chair of the Oregon Commission for Child Care. Kitty mentioned that earlier. I am carrying both a memo for myself, which you already have, as well as a letter from Oregon State and Bobby Weber, who is the coordinator of the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership. And Kitty has done a very eloquent job of saying in a very concise manner what I also would like to reiterate, that we have children in Oregon in need of quality and safe, adequate child care available to working parents, parents who make much better employees if they know that their children come to a safe child care setting. And we appreciate what you're looking at, and we appreciate your strong consideration in support of DHS budget.
Any questions? Any questions for Rosetta? I guess not. I know Bobby Weber from a long time ago. Tell her I said hello.
I will. She's internationally renowned as a research expert.
She's really amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have our first panel, Abby Solomon, Gypsy Dance, Portia May, and Wanda, is it Winnie?
Winnie.
Apologize. Welcome.
Hello. Hi, my name is Abby Solomon. I'm with SEIU Local 503, and I just want to start by saying how excited we are to be here today. I'm here with some fellow child care providers, and we're here representing 5,000 other license-exempt family, friends, and neighbors child care providers around the state of Oregon, and we're really excited to be here to support a great budget that has been proposed by the governor that really invests in our child care program. SEIU child care providers work days, nights, weekends to care for Oregon's lowest income children. They teach them, feed them, comfort them, play with them, and allow the parents to go to work knowing that they're in a safe, quality environment. Providers in the state's Family, Friends, and Neighbors, or a license-exempt program, care for three or less children in their homes at rates that are well below the minimum wage. And they really feel the pain of parents who can't afford to pay the extremely high co-pays that are expected of them, and often have to make hard choices about whether to continue providing care for children after parents maybe got a raise at work and no longer qualify for the program. The employment-related daycare program is designed to help working parents stay in the workforce and contribute to our economy while giving low-income children the stability and quality care that they need to grow and develop. SEIU supports the much-needed investment in Oregon's child care system that the governor's budget provides. The governor's budget will make child care more accessible and more affordable for working parents and for kids. The $35 million investment is really long overdue, and I know there were some questions yesterday during the hearing about this amount of money. And although the numbers seem high, I think it really reflects that we haven't seen a meaningful investment in this program since its inception more than 10 years ago. And I just wanted to have folks keep in mind as they're looking at that number a little bit about what these rates really mean and what the changes in the copays are going to mean. And so I did bring with me a chart if people are interested in what the proposed rates will do for exempt child care providers. And even though it's a large amount of money, the actual take home for providers is working off of a very, very low rate to begin with. And so we're seeing on the low end rates that are going to go up by 13 cents and on the high end rates that will go up by 85 cents. So all across the board, it's still under a dollar that we're talking about for folks. And in our case, we watch three or less children who can't make minimum wage caring for three children in their homes. So I do have this if people are interested in seeing, seeing the rates. So we're hopeful and excited that this does mean more money in the pockets of providers, which goes back in to help kids, help parents, but I also wanted people to really keep it in perspective around what it means for people. With me here today are several child care providers who have stories about working in the employment-related daycare program, and I'd like to let them go ahead and tell their stories, but also before they do that, we know that it's hard to get providers here. Folks are taking care of kids during the day, and so it's hard for them to make the trip from around the state to be here at 1 in the afternoon in the middle of the week in Salem. And so we went ahead and collected some of the stories of folks who live in your districts, and we have them ready for you here. We've got for each member of the committee a series of stories, in some cases photographs, talking about what it's like for parents, kids, and providers, and I'd like to go ahead and distribute those for you as well so you can think about that in addition. And we'll take questions afterwards, and I'll turn it over to Gypsy.
Excuse me. My name is Gypsy Dance, and I live 4945 Northeast Grand in Northeast Portland. And I'm a care provider for a friend. I've been friends to her for 25 years. And the weekend couldn't give her a child because she has a trust issue. She doesn't trust, she doesn't leave any strings with her child because she had one child that was molested. So she's very, she doesn't want anyone to take her a child that she does not know. What we came for this program is friends, family, and neighbors. And it's important that not to put children with strangers. I'm asking you to support the governor's budget, which will give us 20 to 60 cents per raise. I earn $2.49 an hour. So even if it's 20 cents or 60 cents, that still leaves us less than $3 an hour. And I don't know where any place in the United States that somebody would work for $2 an hour. $35 million might sound like a lot, but when all breaks down, we're still getting less than $3 an hour. So it sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot when you spread it over the daycare providers. I've been through a background check, and I love my work. But I live in an apartment, so I can't be certified, you know, to be a worker of daycare provided home. So I just take care of one or two children, which I didn't want to take care of more than that anyway, because I'm into teaching and nurturing. If I have more than three children, that would be too much for me. But I really appreciate you listening to me today, and thank you very much. And I hope you consider the budget.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Wanda Wayne. I live in Northeast Portland, and I am a child care provider for my daughter, who is a single parent, and I take care of my granddaughter before and after school. I make $2.12 an hour, and my daughter hours vary, so she's only entitled to 171 hours a month. That equals like $342 for the month. And my daughter's copay is $231, and I receive a total of $111 during the month. I take my granddaughter and her brother to doctor appointments and dentists. And when my granddaughter is sick, she stays with me, and my daughter does not have to worry about finding child care for her. And I am asking for a raise in pay and a cut in the copay for my daughter because she cannot pay it. My daughter says that she wants grandparents to get paid for their time because her daughter's in a safe and happy with her grandmother being there. I would like for you to vote for Ted Kulikowski's budget plan, care plan. And I want to thank you very much for the time to listen to my story. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Portia.
Hello, my name is Portia Moy. I live in Northeast, and my address is 435 Northeast Holland, right off of MLK. It's easy to find. I just want to come today to share with you about training. The child care providers need the training. We need the help so we can go out and help our grandchildren to prepare them for school. That's very important to the child care providers. We're mostly grandmothers, and you know grandmothers love their children. And today I'm here to ask you to, you know, consider the government a budget. We need the money so we can have the training, so we can have child development. And child development, we get an opportunity to learn about the growth of the child and their development. There are different stages, and that's very important. And even in the training, we get to learn about health and safety and first aid. If anything happened to that child, then we're able to take care of that child or get some assistance from a doctor or someone if it's something that we cannot take care of. We need that. And not only that, we need orientation. Because when we come into the program, we need to go through a training to learn about the job that we're doing. You know, when you go to a job, like I might work for WAC or some state, they take you through an orientation. And the child care providers, they need that orientation too. And I just love it if you consider the budget and support the governor in this budget, because we need the help. The grandmothers, we're concerned about our children. We want the best, because this is our tomorrow, and we want to train them in the right way to go. And thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. Well, I'm sorry I mispronounced your name.
Okay.
Senator Westman.
Two comments.
Okay.
One, thank you for your very, very compelling testimony. You guys did great. And secondly, for the record, these ladies came and visited me in my office, and it is by far the best meeting I have had yet in this session. So thanks for being so much fun.
Thank you for having us.
And Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to thank the panel, Gypsy, Wanda, and Portia. Thank you, Billy. Because we do know that the family, friends, and neighbor care that you're providing is absolutely a critical piece of our child care system, mm-hmm. and really appreciate you coming down today. I know you have a lot going on, and thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank you, too. Lucky kids. Lucky kids to have you, grandmas and friend.
Okay. So before we go, I forgot to hand this out. If anybody wants to, I know there was some question about the co-payments, and this is a chart that we used that came from DHS that shows that there are big cuts in the co-pays on the high end and smaller in the middle, and actually no changes on the bottom. And so just kind of how that works itself out.
Thank you, Abby.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And just to add on, we didn't really get into this at the presentation, but there is some training dollars, as mentioned by one of the panelists, that in addition to increasing the reimbursement rates, we're also looking for some additional training, which is, gets to some of the quality piece we're talking about.
That's great. Okay. And if it makes you feel any better, we're kind of in the same income bracket up here. The longer hours you work, the more it goes down.
I think to address Tina's comment about the training, I mean, one of the things that is very exciting about this budget is the opportunity to have training for exempt providers.
Yes.
You know, we've heard many comments over the years about licensing versus being exempt. And for our folks, you know, a lot of people like Gypsy who live in apartments or in some cases trailers or other living environments where we can care for kids in our homes, but we certainly can't run a business, that having the opportunity to still go through the same training programs so that we can have that in addition and still be able to provide quality care is really important, and also in maintaining, you know, parent choices so that they can find providers that they feel comfortable with.
Yes.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Our next panel is Janice O'Malley, Shauna Aldis, Manon McDonald, and Guadalupe Alvarado. I hope I didn't mispronounce too much.
Guadalupe, I'm actually looking for parking.
Oh,
she'll be here soon.
Okay. And welcome to our committee. Thank you for coming today.
Happy birthday.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janice O'Malley, and I'm testifying today in support of House Bill 5031 on behalf of Child Care Providers Together, AFSCME, Local 132. And sitting with me is Shauna Aldous and her son, Shauna's sister, as well as Marion Donald. I just want to be brief since I want them to be able to tell their stories. Local 132 represents about 4,300 registered and certified child care providers in the state. These providers oftentimes don't receive the same amount of respect for the education that they give, their professionalism, and their commitment to child development and safety. They are the source of early care and education to prepare children for success in school and keeps about 90,000 parents on the job. And I just wanted to, I know Senator Gordley and Senator Bates aren't here right now, but I wanted to extend my appreciation for them and the comments that they made yesterday about fully funding ERGC and also how it relates to really lifting working families out of poverty. And actually passed out to all of you the subsidy rates and the subsidy charge shows where they're at now and also what the 75th percentile looks for them. And I included also the National Women's Law Center state-by-state comparison on eligibility, co-payments, and state reimbursements. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. And I apologize. It is Marion. They're here. Okay, go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Brandon Aldous. I live in the city. And I'm speaking on behalf of my mother, Shanna Aldous, as she is not able to speak clearly because she has meningitis. My mother is a child care provider. She has been providing child care for 13 years, and she's here to support HB 5641. When my mother started child care 13 years ago, it was a way to stay at home and raise her children. After watching a few children for about a year, she decided to become a registered at that time. She began to accept children into care that were receiving child care subsidy for the year. As her business, she decided to go back to college to get a degree in early childhood education so she could learn how to educate children the right way. But after finding out that it would cost her plus the cost of $9,500 per staff to work during all the hours she would be at school, the total is $21,800. My mom decided that she could not afford to attend college at that time because she did not make enough money to go. 2 years later, she was able to afford to enroll in such a Jamaica College part-time and will receive her degree in about 1 year. My mom's child care is considered to be high quality because of the years of experience. She is a Step A of a program registry with over 700 hours of training in child care. Large group homes, certified, and a great child care education. My mom's question to you is,
should she quit accepting children on subsidy into her care because they cannot afford her prices she could charge, or should she continue to keep her price low enough to that low-income children can be enrolled and educated in quality child care, like higher-income children can? All children, no matter what their parents' income is, should have quality care and education. With an increase in subsidy pay, child care provider would not have to scrape up money or wait 10 years to be able to afford more education and visit in their child care to become a quality child care. We believe that children are very important and they are our future. So why are people who provide doggy daycare receiving more pay than child care providers are receiving for children from child care subsidy? Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you, Brandon. Questions? Representative Nathanson.
I just wanted to thank Brandon for being able to do this today on behalf of a mother and everyone else who would have had the same thing to say. Not only did you do a very good job, and I understood the story very well, but I think you set a wonderful example for other people your age. Thank you.
This is my first time. I'm nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous.
Okay, my name is Autumn David, and I provide care here in Salem. I am. I've been doing child care for 10 years. I'm certified for up to 16 children, which is the highest certificate in Oregon right now. I am in part of the Oregon Registry, which is gives you the credit for the education that you have. I'm step 9. Anything further than that, I would have to go beyond education. And at this time, I'm not sure. I went back to school and got my degree in criminal justice, and so I have a degree in criminal justice, but I'm not sure at this time in my life if I want to pursue, keep on doing child care or criminal justice. But after doing my work study in the juvenile detention, I guess it really opened my eyes to wanting to continue my child care business instead of pursuing my criminal justice degree. I see the kids in there, and I just feel that we have way too many juveniles in, you know, situations like that, that I think giving the children a younger stability that they need, you know, that we in our community, we have so many things that the children need to face that they really need the stability of providers qualified to give them what they need as young children. You know, they're our future. They're going to be our next generation. With the society the way that it's going, we have many special needs children coming from drugs and violence from the home. I feel our families do a really good job in showing them what a stable environment is, keeping the children. I was at a conference one time where they said that children will have, they will see more providers in their life than you see the same person at the gas station you go to. You know, and that really struck me is of the stability that these children need in their life. And parents that don't have that, the finances to pay the providers, or their income goes up so high that the state cuts them off and their co-pays are so large that they can't afford us anymore. You know, they just get bounced around and around, and that's where the instability comes from. I feel by receiving a higher subsidy pay, we can reinvest in our child cares and have more education that the children, for us as providers, to get so the children, you know, can be taught by going into school. And there's many children that may qualify for Head Start, but the parents' hours don't fit to be able to, you know, go to Head Start programs, and so we're it for them. And we have to pick up the hours that normal schools cannot do. So we're giving them that Head Start. And I think by financing more education and letting the parents be able to afford better quality child care can give them that Head Start that they need.
Thank you. You did great. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit more about the children under your care, like how many children you can, you're certified to do up to 16 children, is that?
Yes, I can have, when you get infants in there, your numbers change. I do not do any children under 2 because of the numbers. Having to pay more staff, I can't afford more staff. By myself, 2 and over, I can have 10 children. With 16, you have to have a helper, so you're paying your staff.
So do you have any children of special needs?
At this time, I do, and I've had a couple that walk in with me that have, like, autism and Asperger's syndrome, and But right now, they're waiting. Right now, his mother's waiting for they interviewed me last week, and they want to start with me, but I cannot start because the mother does not have the finances to pay me first, and the subsidy budget is a month behind in approving applications. So
what's the age range of your children?
I've got a couple at 2 years old, and up until they no longer qualify for the subsidy. Most of my children are on subsidy, and I charge subsidy rate just because my parents are very single parent families that can't afford anymore. I am very low on my rate, even at for the education that I have, that I feel that God has given me the ability to influence on these children's lives that they won't have, if they're not. The stability is more important to me at this time than the money, but I can do a lot more if I have the money.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. Yeah. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Marion? Hi. Chair Boone, members of the committee, my name is Marion McDonald, and I'm a state-certified family child care provider in Northeast Portland. For the last 11 years, I've operated as I grow. I serve infants and toddlers ranging in ages from 6 weeks to 3 years old. Realistically, a lot of children graduate from my program when they're about 2.5. I'm here as a voice for Oregon's 4,400 licensed child care providers to support House Bill 5031 to increase child care subsidies. In the years that I've been caring for young children, I've seen a lot of changes in families. More single parents, more drug-affected families, a lot more transitions in children's lives. While the cost of living has steadily increased, as we all know, subsidized child care rates in Oregon have not increased for at least 12 years. Our state now has the distinction of being 50th in the nation, at the bottom, in its subsidy rates. I'm the sole support for myself, and I can't afford to care for subsidized children. I was doing the math driving down from Portland this morning, and with the current subsidy rates, I would need to care for 16 infants and toddlers, and that would include paying for staff to meet my basic needs. My lease on my house, my car payment, my health insurance. 16 children. There's nothing more distressing to me. To tell a family that I can't even consider caring for their child because they receive a state subsidy. With a proposed subsidy increase, I would be able to care for those children. A lot of grandparents are able to make up the difference, but the reality is parents call me, I have the space, and I just can't take them. I have to support myself. For many children, child care is their home away from home. And the provider is one of the more important role models in their lives. When I cared for an infant 5 days a week, 10 hours a day, for 2 years, that child has spent 50% of their waking hours with me. Child care providers are an important element of Oregon's economy. We make it possible for families to gain and retain employment. Or as you heard before, some families may lose their jobs if they don't feel comfortable with their child care, or they have to take time off work. We pay taxes, we purchase products, and most importantly, we provide for the health, safety, and well-being of our young children. And I see very, very young children. We're on the front lines for early intervention. We see all those things that are happening that I totally support all the other programs, but I really think that infants and toddlers have really been left out. We need to be adequately compensated for the valuable work we do and the contribution we make to our communities and our state. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
Senator Wesson.
Oh, Senator Bates.
You were here.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it, especially taking infants and toddlers. I know many people just can't do that, and so it's a real extra. Can you tell me something about, kind of describe what the average family looks like here? I mean, is it a single mother with several children working? What does that family look like? And I know those people must feel difficult for them to drop their infants off to you, and those kids must wonder sometimes who their mother is if they're spending half the time with you and half the time with their mother.
Mm-hmm. Currently, I don't care for any state-subsidized children, and currently my clientele is basically two-parent families because of the rates I charge. I keep a very small group. Although I'm certified for 12 children a day, with an assistant I care for maybe a daily max of 6 children. It's best practice. It doesn't make me a lot of money, but I think taking more children would be really hard. I have spent the last 2 years canvassing the state, talking to other providers, though, in answer to your question. Other providers that do take subsidized children. And I would say that I won't give you percentages, but yes, there's the young single mom who might have 3 children. The children might have various fathers who aren't in their life. She's trying to get back her life back on track. Maybe she's had substance abuse. There's, you know, we read the papers. You listen to this all the time. You know what goes on, but for her, for that family, or even a two-parent working poor family like my son and his wife and their children, they both have full-time jobs, but quality child care is really difficult. And those families often go to a provider that, and there are a lot of good providers, but often what I see is providers getting in over their heads with too many children, and that's what our families have to settle for. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Guadalupe Alvarado. I am a family child care provider from Springfield, Oregon. I've been doing this since 7 years ago or plus. So the reason that I'm here today is to let all you know that even when I've been for 7 years in this field, I have more than 400 hours of training, and that includes community-based training and college credit classes. So for me, being in this field, it's my career, it's my life, it's my passion. I started being helping the teachers in Head Start, and that what I got, my passion, what I build of all this that I feel, it comes from the bottom of my heart. Seeing all those kids from low-income families needing a lot of health, needing a lot of things from the Head Start program, and that one of the teachers told me, I know this is that you need to do because you was born for this. This comes naturally in you, so you don't come to work with us in Head Start. You need to open your own family child care or center, because it seems to me that this comes naturally for you. So in my daycare, I do watch kids from 2 months to 13 years, and the kids that are out of my daycare came from different background families, and also from most of the families in my daycare, actually, they are low-income parents, single parents, single mothers who have kids with special needs, autism, early intervention, and I'm trying to do my best to keep those families in my care, even when most of them, they come from the subsidy system, and I know that doesn't fit on my budget, that I still be very low-income person, but for me, the most important thing is be somebody in the life in those kids, because for me, I think that building the foundation of those kids and being a structure for those kids will be a huge difference in their lives when they grow up, because to be realistic, now parents, specialist in complaints, they are spending up to 10 hours a day working and away from their own children. So for me, I don't try to just go and take the places of those parents, because I know I can fit that position, but at least I can be there for them when they need me, to feed all the necessities that they have, to build those strong bonds with them, to help those families to raise those kids. That is the most important thing for them, to succeed in school, but also in life. Because if we don't build any foundation with those kids, we don't build those strong bonds in working as a team with this family, what will happen with those kids? We know that jails is full of kids that they never learned to read well, or they have a childhood with many problems. So I've been in this field because I don't want those kids to happen for the same situation. Because I'm a mother, and being a mother for me is one of the most important things in this life, making a difference in the lives of those kids. Even when I do not qualify for the medical insurance, my kids don't have any medical insurance. But I'm there for those kids because they need me. I know there are many professional family child care providers who do not afford VHS families because they cannot afford for their budget. But even when I'm under my budget, I decide to stay there. And I know if we get this huge increase, I will do so much better, because I will be able to pay for more education for me, to provide more materials for those kids, and to do better in the life of those kids and make that big difference, that huge difference. Because it's unfair be a single mother with special needs kids who needs to go to work, who needs to take time off from work to take her children to appointments, to different places where they need to go in order for them to get education, to get what they need. It's very important for me to be a partner with those families, to work as a team, to let other agencies come to my house and teach me how I need to work with those children who have special needs. Because I know I will be better for them. That will be the best place for them to be, in a place where it's secure, it's safe, it's a loving person, and the mother can afford to be there and go to work without no problems. Not thinking what's going on with the kids at my house, if they are safe or they are secure and I'm providing enough food for them. So she has to go to work with not thinking that there is a problem with the kids, and be more productive at work. Because when parents are not productive at work, they have to lose their job. Or sometimes if they cannot find the quality that they need for their kids, to provide care for their kids, it's very hard for them to stay at work. And most of those parents, they decide to stay at home and be a working family and still living under the system, because it's very hard on them. Also, if we are able to raise those the subsidy system for family child care providers, we can prepare better, have more education, return more professional family child care providers on the field to taking care of those children who really need us. Right now, I think is the most important part. Educate more family child care providers. We have more budget to go for more education. Create more programs for those family child care providers to qualify for more education. Thank you.
Thank you, Guadalupe. And I can tell that Head Start teacher's right. You're born for this job.
Thank you.
And thank you for all you do. Any questions? Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank this panel as well. I think it was Marian, Shauna, Guadalupe, Autumn, and then Brandon. I don't know if Brandon ran off too quick. Thank you. You know, you're providing a very critical part of what we need to keep families working. And I think this panel and the previous panel really emphasized that not only are we going to improve access and provide more stability, but we're really going to get at the quality issue here. And one of the things that was mentioned by several folks was the importance of our community colleges and their early childhood education programs. And that's, you know, that's a different committee and a different budget, but that's a very important part of improving our child care workforce as well, is providing that training. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much. And I am at this point going to turn the gavel over to a very, very qualified colleague of mine, Senator Westland. He's even better than I am at this. Thank you.
I thought we agreed with very, 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 very qualified.
Very, 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 very qualified.
I think we ought to vote on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
And just for those of you that are wondering, while we're so kind of gathered up here, and I invite everyone to come down, maybe get a little closer, Alan Bates is not an outlier. We just don't like him.
I'm just a liar, you know.
Yeah. Rob Porter. Enter and sign in, please.
Testimony.
You can drop that over there.
Mr. Chair, it should be pointed out for the first time in this committee's relatively young existence, the males on this committee now outnumber the females.
I'm not going there. Mr. Porter.
Chair Westland, members of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, my name is Rob Potter, for the record. I live at 8310 Southwest 133rd Avenue in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm the chair of the Family Service Review Commission, and I'm representing the commission here today. I provided you with copies of my written testimony. Pardon the scratchy voice, kind of getting over about it, laryngitis. The Family Service Review Commission is an advisory body created by statute to represent the interests of clients served by the Department of Human Services. The commission is currently very engaged in proposed changes to TANF program in response to the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. We're concerned that new state legislation not only complies with federal requirements, but also creates opportunities for program changes that help Oregon's most vulnerable families with children to get the help they need to be self-sufficient. Just some statistics. You've not heard of these before. Oregon's new TANF legislation will affect approximately 18,000 Oregon households each month. TANF caseload represents 41,000 people, including 30,000 children, so it really is a children's program. And approximately 98% of TANF households have no income. I think that's kind of surprising. Or maybe not. The Commission recognizes the significant challenge to crafting new legislation given the complex nature of TANF and the population it serves. We ask the legislature to take necessary time to weigh implications of making changes to TANF because the program makes such a critical difference in the lives of vulnerable children. Furthermore, DHS staff and contractors will need time to prepare for implementation and train staff for a smooth transition to new TANF policies. And we know this will impact the customer service level of clients. The Commission recommends the legislature put the TANF Oversight Committee's conceptual framework or strategy into legislation and provide sufficient funding to ensure success. This was a committee that convened in 2006 to review and compare the new federal requirements and existing Oregon TANF program. The committee's strategy includes a pre-TANF program, which is funded with TANF and MOE money, an ongoing TANF program, which is TANF and MOE money, a post-TANF program with MOE money, a state family SSI program with non-MOE money, state money, and state two-parent program with non-MOE state money. And I wanted you to have a chance to see who was on the commission. There's an attachment A to my testimony here today, which has a roster of the folks that served on the TANF Oversight Committee. And I especially wanted you to note that there were a number of state legislators on the committee, including Representative Kotek over here to my right. I just thought that was a very important, very distinguished group of folks. The Commission understands that additional state general fund dollars will be necessary to implement some of the strategies. However, each component is necessary for TANF families to create the economic stability that leads to self-sufficiency. And the Commission wanted to emphasize parts of that committee's TANF strategy and some committee recommendations, and I'll go through those quickly now.
Potter?
Yes.
We have those very articulately stated here. If you can summarize those, I'm not trying to cut you off or be rude, but we have a long list of witnesses that were committed to getting in a short amount of minutes.
You bet. I'll just cut to the chase here on some of the ones that we think are most important. In particular, on the ongoing TANF, the Commission recommends a TANF grant increase along with a subsequent yearly cost of living increase. A family of three currently receives a TANF cash grant of slightly more than $500 per month, just 36% of the federal poverty level. The Commission also recommends that Oregon fund 12 social service specialists to act as consultants on multi-barrier cases. I think currently that had been taken out of the budget. The Commission also recommends the restoration of policies that would allow families to receive some child support while receiving TANF assistance. The Commission also recommends income limit of program eligibility to be expanded to 200% of the federal poverty level. Oregon currently ranks 48th in the nation for its low income limit, which has not been raised since 1991. Raising the income limit will provide vital assistance to struggling Oregon families, help them fulfill federal work participation requirements. I think I'll just sum it up by saying the TANF Oversight Committee, in a pretty short period of time, came up with a pretty elegant way to address the needs of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens. And the Commission would like to see that the budget provides sufficient funds to make this strategy work. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions or comments? And you did write very legibly. I just didn't.
That's all right. Sometimes it comes out Rod Porter, so
yeah.
That's how it goes.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Sarah Burton, Oregon Food Bank.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
We've got about 3 minutes per person to get everybody in.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I would just, for the record, like to apologize to those who come for public testimony this afternoon. My bill on use of deadly force is up in another committee, and I needed to be there. And again, I just apologize for not being able to be present. But we'll listen to the tapes and do the DVD. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm here today with Michael Leachman, and I'm going to let him go first.
Chair Westland, members of the committee, I'm Mike Leachman. I'm a policy analyst at the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm going to talk to you today about the TANF program. I have 4 points to address with you today. The first is that Oregon needs to increase the TANF income limit. Families of three living at half the poverty line are now considered too rich to receive TANF. In fact, families of three have to be at 43% of the poverty line in order to be eligible today. Oregon's income limit ranks us as the 48th highest income limit in the nation. And as you know, to improve our work participation rates and avoid federal penalties, we're going to have to bring more workers into the program. Raising the income limit would help us to do that. Second point is that we'd urge the committee to work to restore integrity to how Oregon spends its TANF dollars. More TANF money should go to help TANF recipients. We're spending a quarter of combined TANF and MOE dollars on child welfare. We're talking roughly $120 to $130 million of TANF MOE spending each biennium going to child welfare. Now, we that's a lot of spending that could be going to improve Oregon's work participation rate that isn't. Now, we don't advocate cuts to our ailing child welfare system. We shifted TANF and MOE money to child welfare because the rules allowed it and because our child welfare system needed funds. However, we think that the committee should work to improve the child welfare system while bringing TANF funds back to TANF recipients and using TANF and MOE spending to improve Oregon's work participation rates as much as possible. We have a long way to go in our work participation rates. Spending a quarter of our resources in another program area is not helping. Third point, Oregon needs to increase the TANF grant amount. It's lost a third of its value over the last 15 years. And we should also set it to adjust for inflation annually so we don't find ourselves in the same position 15 years from now. Fourth and final point, we'd ask that the committee keep in mind that the spending on the TANF program has collapsed. Really, there's no other word for it, and I'd refer you to the figure 4 in the charts that I've handed out today. Total spending in Oregon on self-sufficiency programs, that includes cash assistance, child care, employment services, and emergency assistance, has declined from $791 million in the 93-95 biennium after you adjust for inflation to just $434 million in the current budget cycle. That's a decline of over $350 million in real terms since 93-95. Yet Oregon's poverty rate is flat over that period, and incomes for poor families are flat too. We applaud the governor's proposal to restore the income limit in the ERDC program. It's where it was prior to the downturn. Keep in mind, though, that this spending amounts to only about one-tenth of the spending cuts that have been wrought in self-sufficiency programs since welfare reform. We urge the committee to support substantial additional funding for TANF reauthorization to restore some integrity to the program, increase its reach, and better serve some of Oregon's most vulnerable children. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'll give Sarah a chance now.
Michael, thank you. Any questions?
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Sarah?
Chairman Westland, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Merton, and I am an associate of Ellen Lowe's, testifying today on behalf of the thousands of low-income Oregonians served by the Oregon Food Bank and their statewide network. As you've heard earlier this week and today, Oregon's TANF program is really at a critical juncture, and we have a long way to go in order to meet these new federally mandated work participation rates. But it also provides Oregon an opportunity to really look at TANF and changing the program to really fully meet the needs of low-income families in this state and increase the odds that those families can not only get off of welfare but really able to transition off of welfare and out of poverty. I want to talk to you today about an opportunity that is provided under the Deficit Reduction Act, and that has to do with the Child Support Pass-Through Program. In the DRA, there was a provision included that states that the federal government will waive its share of child support collections up to $100 for one child or $200 for two children or more. Currently, state and federal governments, when they retain child support collections of those who are on the TANF program, the state is mandated to send a portion of that to the federal government. It is based on the federal Medicaid match rate. So in Oregon, that's about 61 cents on the dollar. Federal law used to mandate that states passed through the first $50 of child support collected for TANF recipients. And under the 1996 welfare law, that mandate was eliminated. And Oregon, like many other states, ended their child support pass-through program. Even though research and common sense have clearly stated that child support collections and the amount of money collected increase when some of that money goes directly to non-custodial parents' children. So we really believe that this
Reinstating a child support pass-through program makes a lot of sense for Oregon families. It can be a really significant source of income for families and help provide some needed financial stability. In Oregon, the money that is retained in child support collections does not go to reimburse the state for the cost of cash assistance. Rather, it is used within the Department of Justice to help fund their child support collection program. There is a proposal out there this session that would restore a child support pass-through program, and the Department of Justice has prepared a fiscal analysis of that proposed pass-through. But the analysis really fails to take into consideration the potential cost benefits to the state provided by increased collections and decreased need for public assistance. About 10 years ago, the state of Wisconsin implemented a child support pass-through program in which they passed through the entire amount of child support collected on behalf of TANF clients. And there's been a number of studies of that program, and a very respected study found that the impact of the net cost to the state was neutral. But a more recent cost-benefit analysis actually found that the program saved the state some money. They found that fathers were more likely to pay child support when the money went to their children, and the child support collections increased, and that custodial parents were less likely to need other types of benefits, namely child care subsidies. So we recognize the importance of child support and collections programs, but we believe that Oregon should find a better way to fund these programs. Many custodial parents, non-custodial parents, are low-income themselves, and we don't believe that low-income families and poor children should be asked to shoulder the cost of a child support enforcement program. We think that parents would be more likely to pay child support if they knew these benefits were going directly to the children. Next year, the federal government will begin waiving its portion of child support collections, and we believe that Oregon should strongly consider taking advantage of this new option and up to the maximum amount and helping low-income TANF families. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions, comments, Tina?
Thank you, Chair Wesson. Just a quick comment. Thank you, Sarah and Mike. The TANF bill that I have proposed does deal with the pass-through issue, so hopefully we'll get to discuss that.
That's great. Thank you.
I'd also like to compliment Mr. Leachman and point out to the committee is very good slide, figure number four. The decline in self-sufficiency programs, and while this is way too simple, certainly mirrors the passage of one particularly draconian ballot measure. And so, small editorial comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Hebb and Mr. Mann, enter sign-in, please. Speak forcefully, articulately, succinctly. As well as fast. No pressure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I will try to live up to the challenge. I appreciate the committee's attention to these important issues today, and want to just briefly explain why the Oregon Law Center is here today in support of these issues. As you know, our mission is to accomplish access to justice for low-income Oregonians, and we set our priorities based on the feedback that we get from communities, from our clients, from other service providers that are across the state, and as you might imagine, issues related to the self-sufficiency programs are of vital importance to our clients and are therefore a great priority for our program. My colleague John Mullen and I are here today to talk to you about several of the benefits. I will defer to Mr. Mullen to talk with you about the majority of the self-sufficiency program benefits. I'd like to focus my comments today specifically on one program, the Temporary Assistance to Domestic Violence Survivors Program, which is referred to as TADVS.
The reason that that program is very important to me and to a number of our clients is that, unfortunately, domestic violence is a public health epidemic nationally and in Oregon, and it is a rising cause of concern for our clients when they come to us and seek help. A number of their problems, whether they are related to their ability to care for themselves economically, their ability to stay safe, their ability to manage problems caused with creditors, a number of their legal problems are caused or related to domestic violence. And so we are learning more about that issue, working closely with domestic violence and sexual assault service providers throughout the state, and we have become aware of how vitally important the TADVS program is to clients, to survivors who are fleeing violent homes and need to get safe. And for that reason, I want to stress my support for the continuation of the TADVS program, and also to reflect upon how incredibly important it is that frontline staff at DHS offices are well-trained and well-supported in making assessments of clients as they come in the door, particularly if clients are in immediate crisis and they are not sure necessarily exactly what to do to get safe, and they are seeking assistance. They may be in such crisis that they're unable to adequately explain the circumstances that they're in, and they need someone who can help them and sit down and take the time in a respectful manner to truly screen and assess what the concerns are and provide help. And these benefits help people, help save lives. We know that this epidemic in Oregon is killing about 20 people a year in Oregon, and that's men, women, and children who die, and these dollars help people get from an unsafe home into a safe home. And these dollars provide first month's rent, for example, moving expenses, lock changes. They may even just be providing food and clothing because a person didn't have time to pack their belongings before they were forced to flee. So these dollars save lives, and the ability of staff to accurately and respectfully assess those needs and address those needs quickly is of vital importance. So I really appreciate the presentation regarding the importance of staff training, and just offer my support for that. Thank you.
John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Just very quickly, because I had an opportunity to work with a number of you in my previous career as the director of Clackamas County Social Services, working on issues relating to elderly people with disabilities and low-income folks. And I'm very, very happy to be able to come to work with the Oregon Law Center and work with my colleague, Sybil Hebb. I very much believe in the mission of the Oregon Law Center and the mission of working on social justice issues for low-income people, low-income Oregonians specifically. And I just wanted to point out that there are times when we are on opposite sides of the discussion with the department about issues where we have client advocacy or we have disagreements about policy, but in the main, we try to work very productively with the department on issues of concern. I think that the department and the governor have done well in presenting a number of improvements to the self-sufficiency program this time around, so we applaud that effort. And in fact, we look forward to discussing a number of different elements in more detail later on as we get into the discussion about the changes under the Deficit Reduction Act and the effect that that will have on the TANF program and how we can use those changes at the national level as an opportunity to take a look at what we want to do here in the state of Oregon to improve TANF. I also want to just point out that there was earlier this week there was a very good question by Senator Carter about the TANF program and talking about poverty issues and what we are doing to ensure the people that are leaving TANF are getting out of poverty. And I think Ramona Foley very candidly answered the question very well, is that the TANF program was not designed at the federal level to help get people out of poverty. We, of course, hope that will be the case, that people will graduate out of TANF will go on to lead very productive lives. But I think that that question raises a really very good challenge to us to think about a number of things. This legislative session is very exciting to me. I've been down here in one version or another since about 1979. And this session, to me, offers many, many opportunities to work on a variety of things that are very important. They're housing, child care.
We really need to move this along.
Well, and that's the end of my testimony then. I just want to say thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Any comments, questions?
Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Cassie Benton Sorek. And this is what I wanted to get to, folks that I don't see in this building every day. Thank you for being here. Did I say that correctly?
Actually, I'm from Benton County.
Close enough.
I have some.
Cassie Sorek works for us, really.
Okay. I have some written testimonies here for you guys. I'm a single mom of two boys, and I'm self-employed with a child care business. However, at one time, I was on both sides of the fence. I was receiving child care benefits from the state and now am supplying child care for people. And in my experience as a provider, I often have dealings with parents who are eligible or who are not eligible for benefits, yet cannot afford their child care. And parents told me that they had to settle for poor quality daycare where their kids were neglected and not given food, clean diapers, and supervision. Even parents who do get child care benefits have these same problems in their child cares because of low child care reimbursements. Children should not have to suffer in these conditions, I don't think. And even when I received benefits, I could not afford the copay that I was expected to pay monthly. Many times I would end up owing money to my provider. I am in support of reducing the copay, increasing the reimbursements, and increasing the eligibility. And I just want to add that I was forced to drop out of school at one time because of my child care copay that I had, and quit my job. So thank you for giving me a time.
Thank you. Excellent.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cassie, for being here, and thank you for waiting. There was a lot of testimony ahead of you. Thank you.
Wendy. Wendy from Lane County. But please state your name for the record.
My name is Wendy Hubachek.
Do it in your microphone. I can see that.
My name is Wendy Hubachek. And let's see. I have worked in the child care field for the past 32 years and was the director of a quality low-cost child care center in Springfield, Oregon. We served approximately 65 low-income families and 85 children. Our center changed our charge exactly what DHS or Department of Human Services paid, plus the parents' copay. We tried to cut costs as much as possible without affecting the quality of care that we were providing for the children. The high cost of operating a child care center became too costly, and the choice to raise the rates and become a center our clients can no longer afford or close the doors were the choices we had to make. On August 21st, 2002, our center closed, leaving families with nowhere to turn and finding affordable quality care in our area. All children deserve a quality environment to play, learn, and grow in, yet low-income families struggle to find affordable quality care. The quality of child care is directly related to the child's social and cognitive development. Better quality care is associated with better outcomes regardless of the child's background. A parent told me, most of the time, they have to choose between paying rent, paying utilities, buying food, or paying child care. And this parent said she would exhaust her resources at a child care center and move on to another child care center. Her child had changed child care centers 7 times in 1 year. Families who receive assistance from DHS still struggle because of the high copays and because DHS does not pay the going rate for child care today. That sends them in search of child care they can't afford, and what they can't afford is usually not quality care. Another parent who was relieved to find a quality center said that she could afford, said she had to leave her two-year-old child with his great-grandmother. The great-grandmother would put the child in front of the television set and tell him to stay there. When the mother got off work 8 hours later to pick him up, the child would still be in the same spot in front of the television set in a diaper that was so wet it was hanging off his bottom. No children should have to go through that. And this mother said she ended up, of course, feeling horrible about leaving her child there. When she got to work, she would worry about her child and worry about the situation her child was in, but she could afford nothing else. Eventually, it caused problems with her at work because she wasn't able to get her work done because she was concerned for her child, and she eventually lost her job. Higher income families have choices open to them, such as nannies, high-cost child care centers, and half-day preschools. Centers with higher tuitions. Child care centers that charge a higher tuition can pay wages, medical insurance for staff. This helps centers acquire better educated staff, and centers retain their staff. The center I interviewed said the majority of its staff had been there for 9 years or longer, and the newest staff member has worked there for 6 years. Low-income families don't have the same choices in child care, and this puts them at a disadvantage of finding quality, affordable care for their children. One parent told me she did take her child to a licensed child care center who did take her DHS. Her child came home every day with bites, scratches, and bruises. When she asked the teachers what happened, none of the teachers knew what happened to this child. So even licensed centers aren't always quality centers. Many families in our community are forced to leave their children in conditions I wouldn't leave my dog in because of the Welfare to Work program President Clinton instituted in 1997, which doesn't give parents child care subsidies that actually cover the cost of the child care program. Who suffers? Consequently, the children suffer, and our next generation suffers. I now work at a high-cost child care center, and the children receive many extra activities, such as daily walks, swimming lessons, gymnastics, field trips to the Holt Center to listen to music, lunches out once a month. Most of our staff have worked at the center for 10 years, and our teachers have at least an early childhood degree, and some of them also have their bachelor's degree. I feel our families come in and go on our tour and ask me if I accept DHS. I always reply yes. But then I explain to them that they will be responsible for their co-pays and the extra amount of tuition that DHS does not cover, meaning the extra amount that we charge. That's not we charge. Most of these families leave very disappointed, and I feel terrible to have to tell them this. We need to put our children first and see that all children have a quality environment in which to grow, learn, and play in. That means raise the rates and lower the co-pays for our children and our next generation.
Wendy, yes. I very much appreciate the way you not only articulated it, but organized your thought.
Oh, thank you.
That's very good.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to call up the last three as a panel. I don't know if you know each other, like each other, or whatever, but I mean, you're now best buddies. Catherine White, Jennifer Snyder, and Jessica Chauncey. And you are on the rapid renewal program.
Yes.
We're using members. They've got to set up a committee in here, and we've all got to get to other committees. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council and Coalition. I just wanted to very briefly address two populations that I frequently get telephone calls about who are involved with the TANF program. That is adults with developmental disabilities who may not be eligible for developmental disability services, nor
either may not have SSI or may not be eligible for SSI, but are in the TANF program. The other population that I hear about frequently are mothers, usually single mothers, who have very significantly disabled children who are unable to work or maintain employment because of the nature of their children's disabilities. And just very, very briefly, I just want to stress the importance of the initial evaluations and assessments of families as they come into the TANF program, the need to be certain that we're recognizing disabilities. As a former reading specialist in one of my past lives, I know how very skilled people are in diagnosing both their disguising both their disability or their lack of literacy. And I think it's critically important that the assessment of people as they come into TANF is made to identify those disabilities. I think we look at the population we still have in the program, and many people experience disability. I think it's critically important that we understand the impact of that disability, and that the people that are working with these individuals have the skills and understanding on how to work with that disability and develop the appropriate supports to help them become successful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Jessica?
Hi.
It's your time.
Well, so special.
You my come name? Down, and we appreciate you being here. I mean, we need to do move it along, but I mean, relax is what I'm saying.
Okay, I'll try. It's kind of hard being in the hot spot, but anyway, my name is Jessica Cheney, and for the record, I live at 7310 Southeast Thorburn Street in Portland. And I'm here testifying as a former recipient of what's called AMTCA, that my aid to dependent children. It's now TANF. I know about the changes on the federal level that is causing a total redesign of the program. And I have to admit, I feel really lucky to have been on welfare, and I never really thought I would actually say that. But considering the changes that happened in 1996, I was really lucky to be able to get the support that I got for as long as I got it. And I'm hopeful now with these new changes that there can be a program redesign that really helps people be successful. I first applied for welfare back in 1989. My husband and I had just separated, and we had been in the Air Force together. And we were living in Georgia. My children were very young, 2 and 5 years, and things weren't working out, and I decided to go back to Oregon where my family was, and I felt like I could have some support. After exhausting my savings because I couldn't find a job, and we were in the middle of a recession, and I was realizing that the kind of work I did in the Air Force really didn't translate well into the civilian sector, which I think a lot of people end up finding out at some point. I had to go on welfare. I had no choice. Couldn't pay the bills. I was afraid I wouldn't be able to support my children. Even though I was around my extended family, they weren't doing so well themselves. So that wasn't an option either. So that was a really hard thing to go on welfare. And at the time, welfare allowed mothers that had children younger than 3 years to stay home. They weren't forced to go to work or look for work. But I didn't want to sit at home. I really wanted to do something because I didn't like the situation that I was in, and I was fearful for my future and the future of my children. So they had a 6-month vocational training program that I went through, and was happy to have that opportunity. I went through the program, was very successful, and I got a job at the end. But as soon as I let my worker know that I was employed, I was immediately cut off in the program. And I was living paycheck to paycheck, literally. And most times I juggled my bills and never paid all my bills every month. There was no way that I could wait the 2 or 3 weeks that was necessary in order to get my first paycheck. And so I had to quit my job and go back on assistance, which was extremely emotional for me because I felt like I was doing everything right. I was doing everything the program told me it wanted me to do and that I wanted to, in fact, do for myself and my family. Yet I couldn't make that transition, and so I got kind of depressed. And fortunately, back in the previous iteration of welfare reform, which was 1988, it was called the Family Support Act. We've done this every so often, as you can see. At that point in time, they were really proposing that women, it's kind of an experiment, go through higher education, women in welfare. And I had 8th grade education. I never went to high school. I got a GET just to get into the service, and so I had very little educational background. Didn't feel very confident about going to school, but my caseworker recommended it, and so I gave it a try. And it gave me a lot of hope. I did really well. I got an associate's degree, and then I went on to get an undergraduate degree.
graduated summa cum laude, apparently. I never get to say that very often, but I feel like it's appropriate in this venue because I feel like a lot of times people in our welfare are considered to be not very smart or capable of going through higher education, and of course what's going to come next is me proposing that that be an option that's available to more women that are on assistance, because I think that is the one thing that can really make a difference in creating family self-sufficiency. We can get people prepared for minimum wage jobs and jobs that pay a little bit more than minimum wage, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to be vulnerable and they're not going to be prone to going back onto assistance. I'm proud to say that when I went off of assistance, I stayed off of assistance. It's been 10 years now. And I don't feel like I'm vulnerable or that I'm susceptible to going back on. So I highly recommend that Oregon, when you're making your changes, really consider the option of allowing women that want to pursue higher education be afforded that opportunity. Right now, it's my understanding that there's a degree completion program that is for 24 months or less. And to me, that doesn't allow somebody that was in my situation who hadn't even begun college yet to really even explore that as an option. So I really feel like that would make a big difference. And if you really want families to get off of assistance and do well, then I think that's one of the most important things that can be done. And there's certainly a lot of research out there that shows the correlation between education and earnings. I just wanted to point out one other thing, and that was the child support pass-through that was talked about earlier. When I was on the program, I was allowed a $50 pass-through for a certain period of time, and it really made all the difference in the world. There were times when I didn't have 50 cents in my pocket, and I still had time to wait before the next check was going to arrive. $50 is a huge amount of money when you're only getting $400 to $500 a month. So even if it's a $50 pass-through, hopefully it will be more than that, then I think that is money that's very well spent. It's going to the people that are really going to use it. It's if you're getting those federal dollars as well, which I heard might be an option next year, that keeps more of the money locally in our own state. So I think it's just a win-win for all involved. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today.
Good job.
I knew you were supposed to be last for a reason. Thank you for coming down, and more importantly, I know I speak on behalf of the whole committee. Congratulations not only on getting your degree, but as you say, with honors. Great job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.